This is the Automotive Repair Podcast Network.
Welcome everyone to yet another episode of Diagnosing the Aftermarket A to Z. I'm Matt Fonzel, and you'll find a pair of safety glasses and some earplugs under your seats. Please feel free to use them. That and more after a word from our sponsors, Pico Technology, Autel, and Independent Wrench Jobs. Tired of guesswork in your auto diagnostics? Need to pinpoint faults quickly and accurately? Picoscope will turn your PC into a powerful diagnostic tool. See live waveforms from sensors, injectors, and ignition systems. See the problem? Solve it faster. Visit PicoAuto.com. That's PicoAuto.com. Autel delivers award-winning automotive diagnostic tools trusted by technicians across North America. Backed by Autel North America experts in sales, training, and technical support. From drivability diagnostics and TPMS service to ADAS and advanced safety systems, Autel helps technicians follow OEM procedures and repair with confidence. Learn more at autel.com. Sponsored by Independent Wrench Jobs, tech-only jobs, no runaround. Built by Technician Find, helping tech since 2017. Join free at independentwrenchjobs.com. I kind of threatened it, so I figured I'd do it because I get a fair number of emails and messages asking various questions about my different Rushmores or Rushmores of different things with a fair bit of variety. It's kind of cool, actually. I suspect it's driven by if your algorithms are doing the same thing, but quite a few of them popping up in like Facebook Reels and YouTube Shorts, stuff like that, the various Rushmores of all sorts of different things. So it's kind of cool to be asked what my Rushmores are. And some of them are scary to answer. I probably shouldn't, but that won't be me. Before I get going on the Rushmore, though, I have to give you a short part two to No Good Deed Goes Unpunished, because after recording a couple days later, we get that phone call, the dreaded phone call. There's a water leak. I'm beside myself because I was so careful and I kind of get a kick out of doing plumbing and stuff like that. So I'm freaking out. Like, what did I forget? What did I do wrong? I worked really hard on getting the drain on the sink just right. And it sounds like the leak wasn't coming from the sink, but the bathtub. And all I did was a fascia kit, right? Like we just replaced some of the trim, if you will. So what in the world is leaking? All right, get up there. Luckily, the bottom of the bathtub is somewhat accessible underneath from the utility room, just above the water heater. But I end up standing essentially, not directly, but essentially on the water heater. And come to find out that when they built the house, or I don't know if it was the carpenters, I don't know if it was the plumbers, I don't know if it was both of them, I don't know. But the bathtub where the drain end sits is right above stacked trusses. If you remember from the last episode where I talk about this, these trusses are built out of 2x4s, and I'm not implying that they're crap. I'm just, that's what they're built, and I think they're just fine and totally stout. But to get the drain in, they cut all the way through one top plate, if you will, of a truss, and about halfway or more through the other one. So they're right side by side. So instead of 2x4, they're like 2x8. But one is cut all the way through. The other one's cut almost halfway through that top part. So what they did is they took a 2x10 and nailed it to that truss just under the bathtub, and it ends up just under the drain elbow. The drain elbow is plastic or PVC. I suspect over time, maybe right from the get-go, I don't know, but the tub had very little support under it, right? There's no signs of like a sackcrete type thing or no foam, styrofoam type of an insert to give the tub some, you know, stiffness, if you will, to stand on. Like when you walk or step inside of it, the bathtub flexes. Well, it was flexing on this elbow and eventually it cracked, or I suspect it was stress fractured. When I took out the drain, the drain, if you will, not the elbow, but they screwed the drain out the top and put the new one in, I just took the stress crack and made it a real crack. I don't know how you would know. Unfortunately, the only way to know is the phone call. So what do? We end up prying that 2x10 out, taking the elbow out, and luckily it was a fairly standard piece, if you will. It was like the elbow was part of a, you know, whatever, 1.5-inch PVC pipe going to the S-trap, P-trap, where it would meet the overflow of it, drain, if you will. So we just replaced that part. I put the 2x10 back, but not in the same place. I made a gap and then, you know, put it back in place. I added a couple more screws to hopefully add support. But like I said, man, started out, it's just a birthday present and try to make his bath, or really his toilet, not wobble anymore. And mission accomplished. And the plumbing's probably never been so good, and not that I'm so great. Just, I'm not there. A good question would be for anyone listening that knows, if you send me a message or post it up on the podcast Facebook group or a Facebook page, how do they get paid? Like, if you're part of a crew that puts up these, maybe not just townhouses, maybe spec homes in general, but you work for a company that maybe is just all kind of like an all makes all models. Kind of like basically everybody works under for the same company, the plumbers, the electricians, carpenters, framers, like they're all under the same umbrella, the same company. How are they paid? Like, is it hourly? Is there some sort of a piece rate type thing? Like you get paid per house or per room? What would motivate somebody to do stuff like I saw? Maybe it's common practice. I mean, I've seen some weird stuff. Some of it was minimum code wasn't so good, but this house is, I don't know, 12, 13 years old. So I'm just kind of curious, like, what would be the motivation? Is it whoever put the tub in and that plumbing was just frustrated with whoever designed the house, the engineer or the architect that set this bathtub right over two trusses right under the drain and, well, just make it work. And nobody will know for a decade or more. I'm just curious. But anyways, on to the Rushmore. Yeah, they have to come right out of the gate. What's your favorite? What's your Rushmore of scan tools? And it's kind of a weird, what's that mean? Like, historically, what were my favorite scan tools throughout time? That's how I'm taking it. And because it's a Rushmore, I don't necessarily have to list these in any particular order. These are just my top four, right? So using that, not necessarily recommending what to buy nowadays, but historically, what are my favorite scan tools? Okay. I don't know why, but the Tech 2 is like one of my very favorite scan tools of all time. I suppose it was one I used more than most of the others. General Motors dominated and still dominates the number of cars that come in. I don't use it a whole lot anymore, but when I do, it usually bails me out, whether it's for programming, for like a baud rate type of issue, whether it's like a piece of scan data that the other scan tools just don't seem to have. I think I talked about it once before, but I had a Corvette in, and I'm pretty sure it was like a 96, 97 Corvette. AC didn't work. None of my scan tools showed an AC request. And I'm talking like, I mean, you name it, right? None of them had it. Tech 2 did. You know, just pretty cool. Yeah, Tech 2, it's a near and dear. Another one would be probably, so the first shop I really worked at, so coming out of school, I've worked at a Ford dealership for a short time. it was really like some new car prep, a little bit of repair type work, warranty work that didn't pay well. They would give it to me. I don't know if that really counts. Then I delivered parts for the local CarQuest store for a little while. And that ended up being really important because it just gave me a time to process stuff. Just gave me some time. And then I worked at a Tires Plus for a little while and just hated it. It was not my thing. Tires, steering, suspension, brakes, just, I mean, it didn't do it for me. Probably not the most financially bright move, but to leave, because I think if I would have embraced it, I could have probably made a lot of money early on, but it just didn't speak to me. So that first independent repair shop that I worked for, they had an OTC Monitor 4000 Enhanced. That's what they had. I didn't love it or hate it. It's just what it was. I don't think I knew enough to not like it or to even like it, right? I didn't know what I was missing out on until I started dabbling in IATN, the International Automotive Technicians Network, and getting involved in the forums and then particularly the chat room and finding out that I was missing a lot. The Monitor 4000 had its place, but the next scan tool we got, really because we kept borrowing it from somebody else, was a Red Brick. I mean, I hate to sound all old school, but that tool worked for a long time, and particularly the graphing Red Brick, which came out, I hate to rattle off a time. God, I hate to. I don't know how many years before like the Solus and the Modus came out, but it looked very similar to that first gen Solus, the screen, particularly the graphing part. But god darn it, that thing got me into, stepped into a world I didn't even know existed. Like I was talking to Jeeps before I couldn't talk to Jeeps. You know, they had the underhood data link connector. It just always seemed to do something on everything. Therefore, it was near and dear to my heart because it just freaking worked. And then graphing on the scan tool was just next level. I could do it with the 4000 using something called Easy Event. But it's a process. You know, it looked cool. Everybody thought it was cool because you're uploading stuff to PC, but still. Is your shop ready for the electric vehicle revolution? Don't get left behind. The Picoscope EV Kit is your all-in-one solution. Diagnose any electric or hybrid vehicle, from high-voltage batteries to complex communication systems. With guided tests and pinpoint accuracy, you'll tackle more jobs and boost your bottom line. This isn't just a tool. It's your future. Be the expert in EV repair. Visit PicoAuto.com to future-proof your shop today. That's PicoAuto.com. This episode of Diagnosing the Aftermarket A to Z is brought to you by Autel. Autel is a global developer and manufacturer of award-winning professional automotive diagnostic tools and service equipment, trusted by technicians, educators, and shop owners across North America. With diagnostics at their core, Autel's real-world solutions support repair workflows ranging from full-system vehicle diagnostics to servicing the most advanced automotive technologies. What sets Autel North America apart is the team behind the tools. Dedicated experts across sales, training, and technical support, each bringing deep, hands-on experience supporting professional technicians. When questions arise, you're working with people who understand the vehicles, the procedures, and the real-world demands of modern repair. Whether diagnosing complex drivability concerns, servicing TPMS systems, validating repairs, or working with ADOS and advanced safety technologies, Autel tools are engineered to support accurate, efficient repairs in strict accordance with OEM procedures and standards. To learn more about Autel and their diagnostic solutions, visit autel.com, AUTEL.com. Ever feel like you've got to play politics just to get fed? One guy gets the gravy, you get the garbage. And then the ad says, great culture. Independent Wrench Jobs is a new tech-only community to help you find better independent shops. Fair dispatch, steady work, real leadership, no games. Start with the free salary survey for your city, shop-by-shop pay, perks, and benefits before you waste another interview. And if you're applying now, use Autotech Resume Pro to generate a resume and shop-specific cover letter in about 2 minutes. Built by Technician Find, serving the industry since 2017. Join free at independentwrenchjobs.com. The next one really would have to be the Autel Max Assist. the Pro, like the 908 Pro, was just a bit nice tablet, good size. And it did things for an aftermarket scan tool that Snap-on was starting to fall off, especially in like Euro stuff. I'm not even talking like BMW programming. I'm just saying like adaptions and basic setting type stuff, calibrations. It just did stuff you weren't used to seeing, or I wasn't used to seeing in an aftermarket tool. I guess my brain just lights up with all the tools I like, but I'm trying to not, it's so easy to just say like, you know, IDS for Ford and Y-Tech for Chrysler and Techstream for, or GTS for Toyota. That's not wrong. Like if we could have just like that umbrella, which maybe that should be a choice, but it's not a scan tool, right? It's a kind of an, I don't know, almost like an overarching umbrella is really the best, but philosophy almost. But yeah, it's just that Autel did stuff that was not common to see. You had the DS708 to begin with, already super capable. And then just the Maxxis was just that next step up. And then, of course, that 908 Pro is kind of like when it really, those just resonate to me. The Maxxis is, if I had to choose one between the two, I guess I would say the Maxxis. We'll put that on the list. And then number four, what sucks with the fourth choice is you're omitting so many other freaking terrific scan tools. Like, how do you not mention Vagcom for Volkswagen Audi? I mean, what a freaking tool for the price, what you could do with that thing. Man, but I don't know. Does it make my Mount Rushmore? It probably should. I'm kind of talking myself into it. No. I mean, I have other ideas too. Oh man, the iScan 2WT. I really like that tool. Yeah. God darn it. All right, this Rushmore thing sucks. I don't want to do it anymore. I talked myself into it. That's going to be Vagcom. What a freaking tool. And three of my four, or really all four of them, are kind of dated, which implies I don't like the new ones as much, but the new ones are freaking awesome. Like, I almost feel bad, but we're talking about the Rushmore. Are we implying that the presidents that are carved into the side of that bluff mountain, there hasn't been anyone better since? I mean, I suppose somebody would argue that, but at least they were some heavy hitter forefathers. And I think what I rattled off are some major forefathers. So I'm good with that. Tech 2, Snap-on Red Brick. Graphing particularly. So the MT2500G or MTG2500. I think it's MTG2500. And then the Autel Maxxis taking what the 708. Yeah. DS70. I said 908. So now I'm skewing. It might be 706. And then Vagcom. Ask me in a few minutes. I'll have changed my mind and I'd probably add a more modern scan tool, but those deserve mention. That's what I'm going with. And the next one, obvious. And I have done episodes where I kind of do my top fives and where they're like recommending, but I guess I take Mount Rushmore to be slightly different. That's a slightly different question. The next one's obvious, right? Lap scopes or oscilloscopes. I'm going to go and assume they're not talking like engine analyzer type. And I don't know that I would put them in the same category because really ignition scopes did ignition really, really well. Not necessarily other stuff so hot. The Rushmore of lab scopes from my point of view. How do you not go with the Pico 4425A? I mean, part of me wants to say the 8 channel, but honestly, I love the 8 channel. Mostly because I can do 5, sometimes 6 channels, signals. But I would say the 4425A gets used way more. And the A's got the special adapters that plug in and auto ID the probes and power up like current probes and stuff. So you don't have to worry about batteries. I'm pretty sure Duracell suing Pico because of the loss of sales for 9 volts is significant. I'm sure it's staggering. I'm stunned they haven't folded up yet. Or Energizer and Duracell would have to combine just to keep the doors open. The amount of 9 volts that we would go through. I mean, I don't know, at least one a week, right? I don't know about you guys. Yeah, 4425. It's the best scope out there that I've ever used. After that, I mean, I adore the Vantage Pro. And basically, I'm starting to rattle off my freaking top five from the episode I recorded, but on it. But it's two channel handheld, did more than just that. So I want to stick strictly to this scope portion. So like you could throw in the Snap-on scopes because they really haven't changed, but there's just something with the Vantage Pro. And I guess maybe doing internal amps was kind of a cool thing and it could do it quite accurately. You know, most oscilloscopes really measure voltage and that's it. And they convert whatever it is you're doing through a transducer of some sort. Be that a current probe or a pressure transducer, it changes voltage to whatever scale, where the Vantage would do amps, legit internal amps, and it was scoping like MR sensor, the current, really before anyone else, and doing a pretty stellar job of it. It's got to make it. Yeah, if you want to, I would not put up a big fight if we wanted to throw in like the Modus for four channels, but it wouldn't do internal amps. Or the Snap-on scopes, because they're virtually all the same. They're virtually operate all the same. So I wouldn't put up too big of a fuss, but to name the tool, it would be the Vantage Pro. I still use it and I buy them up when I can find a good deal on them. I just load up on them. We have a bunch of them at the shop. I give them the techs that, mechanical specialists that are looking to do more technical specialist type of activities. I've gotten them regular Vantages. But kind of made the switch to Vantage Pros because the prices now are dropping. Found a vendor for batteries and they're just that good. And I could give a rip about the database. They don't need to build the vehicle. They just set up the scope. How do you not put like the Pico ADC 212 series, namely the 3, because it was the most affordable? How do you not put that on a Rushmore? If we're talking about like forefathers, right? That kind of changed a lot of things for what technicians were demanding from their scopes. Yes, it was PC based. So you had the nice big screen, right? But we had almost all handhelds at the time. And I think at the time we preferred the handhelds, but you know, that big screen's kind of nice and it was pretty. It needed to be plugged into the wall or to the battery on the vehicle. Speed, and more importantly, that memory. At the time, it was like, should probably go look this stuff up before I start recording, but it probably ends up being like 32,000 sample points. So that's what's stored in memory. And at the time, there's nothing that we're getting remotely like that. Like remotely. So how do you not put that in there? How do you not take something that laid the groundwork for most of the scopes we're seeing today marketed to auto repair shops with pretty decent sample rate, but it's not necessarily the big selling point. The memory buffers, they're usually far superior than most of the scopes aimed at more industrial applications. Now, don't get me wrong. Like you can change things on them and buy certain ones that are, you know, absurd, but they're also absurdly priced. And then Pico, the ADC 212 was also a 12-bit scope. So we're doing zooming in and keeping detail. It's just not what we saw at the time. It was so out there. It was so different. And maybe the signals that we were looking at the time didn't necessarily require that, but you could see what it could do versus everybody else. And then is it any wonder the Snap-on scopes come out with being 12-bit, having pretty large buffers, you know, sample point memory buffers? I think not. It has to go. It has to be on the Rushmore. I don't know how you don't. Yeah. The last, but not least. Maybe it is least. I don't know. I think you have to put the Fluke 98 on there. You know, I'm thinking about it. Like, Mac had a scope that was pretty decent. It was a rebadged Tektronix. We had the Tektronix scopes. But really, that was a very niche group using that. All spurned by John Thornton, right? That's where we saw that scope. I don't remember seeing that anywhere else except there was a, was his name Kevin Carpenter? Wrote for Motor Age. Usually had a column or an article at the back of the magazine. It would be a case study. He also used a Tektronix scope. I had seen John using his long before that, and that's not trying to imply either one that Kevin took that from John or not. I mean, I guess if he did, it helped, right? The LS2000, Sun LS2000, that was popular, but I don't think it was as popular as the 98. The 98 was one of the first, I don't know, big boy handheld lab scopes, right? After the big box analyzers really started to go to the wayside. Even I'm trying to think like on IETN, of course, the Snap-on Vantage was very popular, but that you used a little bit differently than a pure lab scope. You had to. It was before the Modus and the Vantage Pros. And Pico might have existed, but too few really knew about it. But the 98 had some marketing behind it. And it was an automotive scope. Like, it had automotive functions in it, automotive setups. And it was, at the time, very capable. Yeah. I think that's the Rushmore. The 4425A is just setting the bar for modern. And also, like, it's my list. It's my favorite. The Vantage Pro and then the Fluke 98 really deserves mention. Out of fear for sounding biased, I think I can make the argument. I think the argument is strong. The Pico ADC 212 series, particularly the three, they had a 50 and a 100. I think I bought a 100 probably just because I could say I had a 100. I don't think there was any real logic behind it. The three, I think, really provided that turning point for what we have available to us now, not just from Pico. From pretty much everybody. All right. The next one. Yeah, I mean, you had to know, right? You had to know somebody was going to ask this. I like the question. I also don't like the question because it's not automotive. And some listeners really like the non-automotive stuff and some kind of go, nah, skip. I'm not scared of the question by any means. It's just kind of had to know it was coming. Matt, what is your Rushmore? And multiple requests. Rushmore of professional wrestlers. One, I fear you guys think I'm a bigger fan than I really am. I appreciate it, though. I do. I really, really appreciate the art and the art form, the entertainment. I do. The issue I have with the question is, to me, how do you define that? Like, I could go, what are my personal favorites? But also, like, categorically, who are the best? But then you have this problem. You have, because it's entertainment and really sports entertainment, you have this problem where you have the ones who earn the money or who were super popular, who drew money. If we want to talk like professional wrestlers, who drew money? And then we have who could go, who could really perform in the ring. They're not necessarily the same. In fact, I don't know that any really cross over from one to the other. So in all fairness, I think I'm going to try to rattle off two Mount Rushmores. We're going to have the Rushmore of wrestlers who drew money or were the most popular, the biggest stars. And then we have the ones that were the best in-ring performers. Like, who could really go popularity-wise, the big money draws. Like, it's kind of like the ADC 212 Pico. How do you not have Hulk Hogan on there? Say anything you want about in-ring skills, lack of skills, locker room, BS, drama, stifling talent, holding people down. He may have done it. He may not have. And my suspicion is he did for some and not others, helped others. he's kind of like the Pico ADC 212 of professional wrestling. And that is a distinct turn for what a professional wrestler could be. Ultra public popular. It wasn't just a certain niche group of that watched. It's now everybody knew who he was. He might have been as well known as or as recognizable as Muhammad Ali. Maybe. Movies, music videos, got hooked up with Cyndi Lauper. Like, yeah, he's on there. It's got to be. After that, The Rock kind of did the same thing. Dwayne The Rock Johnson, right? In his heyday, he drew as much as anybody, and a lot of it because he worked with another addition to Rushmore. You almost can't have one without the other. Stone Cold Steve Austin. He drew money. Compared to the other two, he's more of a flash in the pan, even though he had been doing it for so long. But at his peak was probably shorter than the other two due to injury, right? That neck injury. And then just going so hard for, you know, I hate to say so long because I just said it was a flash in the pan, but it's kind of what ended up happening. And then the fourth one, it's Cena, right? It's John Cena. He has more Make-A-Wish grants than anyone in history, and it's not even close. Like, I think you can take the first three, or I should say the next three or four. So two, three, four, maybe even five providers or grantors, add them together, and they still don't have as many as Cena. That is insane. It's also why Cena didn't get turned heel until way late in his career, almost at the very bitter end. Because how could they do that to the kids? And now we have the performers, the ones that could really go in the ring, the athletes. The easiest one to me, Shawn Michaels, the Heartbreak Kid. He could make anybody look really, really good, especially when he tried. Like you can see some matches where he kind of overdoes it to be, I think, almost a jerk. And there's behind the scenes stuff about all that that could be covered. You can watch all about that. That guy could go, and he could go with anyone. He could make a not so great performer look fantastic, and then a fantastic performer look even better. He could do it all. The next one is Bret the Hitman Hart. The gimmick was the best there is, the best there was, the best there ever will be. The thing is he might have been right. It wasn't just a gimmick name. He can flat out go and had almost endless endurance. Never got tired. He looked tired. Like if you watch his matches, he looks exhausted. No, it's all performance. And don't get me wrong, he's not doing the big moves like, you know, Jeff Hardy, but never really injured an opponent, quote unquote, an opponent. That's amazing. That's amazing to work. He works stiff, like he'd get his stuff in and, you know, it would hurt. But he didn't injure anybody. That's insane. That is just an amazing feat. And then after that, you got to put AJ Styles in that conversation. AJ Styles is another one of those that could just do about anything with anyone. And he did some of the more high flyer type stuff. He could just flat out go. Flat out go. And the fourth one, I almost hate because I have to, there's so many performers that deserve to be in that spot. Kurt Angle, Brock Lesnar, Dolph Ziggler. You got to put Ric Flair in there. I mean, come on. For how many decades did that guy go out and make the other guy look so good? That's what made that championship. Like he was the quote unquote bad guy, the heel. And he had to go from territory to territory back in the old territory days, not when it was nationalized like the WWE made it or WWF at the time, under the banner of the NWA, go from territory to territory and make each territory's champion look like they could win the title, legitimize their title, and still win. That's not nothing. It's got to be. It sucks to leave so many others off that list. We could do another one with the best gimmicks, right? Undertaker, probably Roman Reigns with the Chief. God dang. Yeah. Anyways, go down a rabbit hole that way. Next. Oh, man. Rushmore of podcasters. There's a podcast called Soft White Underbelly. It's really quite good. I don't know the guy's name. I don't know who hosts it. And I don't know if it's a different person each time. I don't think so. But I like that one. And then after that, there's one called Podcasters Chris Williamson. I feel like there's minimal propaganda and just genuinely interested in people and has a fairly wide guest list or spectrum. And then another one is Diaries of a CEO. I like that one too. So that's what, three? If that's a Rushmore and that's my favorite, and I got to be careful, right? That I'm not moving my rules around each set. So I have to be careful, right? Because the Rushmore, I think the other ones, I kind of rattled off what I think are the greatest or the forefathers. I have to be careful with the ones I just rattled off because I don't know. I might leave Soft White Underbelly in there. So let's leave that one. The other two I do listen to, I do like them, but I don't know that that's necessarily following the rules here that I've set forth. So following the rules, how do you ignore Joe Rogan? Say what you will. I think a lot of the stuff he's done is out of genuine curiosity, and he's had a very wide spectrum of guests, and it started out just a comedian interviewing his buddies in some downtime, and it exploded into what it has become. And it's kind of set a standard by what most others are judged against. You can't have a Mount Rushmore of podcasters and not put them on there. That would be absurd. Yeah, there's a lot of guests on there that you can learn an awful lot. And they go, it's a spectrum. That's, I think, the best way I can phrase that. I guess this is going to be a little left field. I'm going to throw in Kevin Smith and Scott Mosier. They're the first podcast I remember ever really knowing about, and they called it Smodcast. And it was just, Kevin Smith is the director of what we would call the Red Bank movies, and a few others. He's Red State and Tusk, to name a couple. There's more, but The Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Dogma, Jay and Bob Strike Back, Clerks 2, Clerks 3, like those are his movies. He plays in those movies Silent Bob so that he could direct and be in the film. It's a neat story with all that, and we can talk about that some other day. But they're the first podcast I was ever really aware of. And they talked about everything, but primarily entertainment, movies, TV shows. And of course, they had some in. Scott Mosier was a producer for those movies. He also was, I believe, the director of the animated version, the newer animated version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. So yeah, a little bit of talent and clout there. They have to be on there. And then number four, that's kind of brutal, right? I got to open up my contract here. I might be contractually obligated to mention Carm. I mean, when it comes to automotive podcasts, right? How do you not? I say that truthfully, like that could be very sarcastic, but really he was the forefather of it, right? The first one that had like prominence, that's undeniable. Is he on the Mount Rushmore with these guys? That's rough, right? Needs to be mentioned, at least in the world of automotive. How do you ignore that? I think the next one for just straight up podcasts, I do listen to him. I really do like him. I don't think this is a favoritism thing. Maybe it is. I don't think so, though. I think he's had some very good stuff. He's been around a while. And I'm going with Lex Fridman. Because now you have an MIT professor who's extraordinarily bright, extraordinarily inquisitive. I guess I'm curious what you guys think about the list in general, but for that one, I'm kind of curious what you have to say about that. But in the grand scheme, I think the first three I'm very, very comfortable with. The fourth one, Lex, I don't know. I think there's a good argument for him. We're going to roll with it. So I've been going at this for quite a while. There were more questions going into like sports and various other things, entertainment, movies, music. I am very curious if you're interested in this type of stuff, this type of content, to let me know. And also if you have more automotive type stuff that you would like a Mount Rushmore of, or at least my thought of what that would be, please don't hesitate to reach out. Fire me an email at mattfonslowpodcast@gmail.com. You can message me on Facebook. You can send postcards to Tracy and then she'll forward them to me. I really appreciate listening. I really appreciate our sponsors, Autel, Pico Technology, and Independent Wrench Jobs. And also, I really appreciate the Automotive Repair Podcast Network, mainly because their name is right there above my head. And they've threatened to let that fall and hit it if I don't mention it. So thank you again. And until next time, which will be after Vision, which is coming up so fast. Actually, when you listen to this, I will probably be on my way to Vision. So yeah, looking forward to that. Looking forward to seeing friends, looking to find new and improved ways to ditch and avoid Sherry and Heather. It's easy. I mean, they wear red. They stick out red or blue. They stick out like sore thumbs. Cake. So anyways, until next time, take care.
You've been listening to Diagnosing the Aftermarket A to Z with Matt Fonslow on the Automotive Repair Podcast Network. Download our exclusive podcast app at automotiverepairpodcastnetwork.com because the best conversations in the industry start here. Want Matt to cover a specific topic? Check the show notes for his email. Your input matters.